Good morning. We have a full house today, which is always very nice. My notes tell me that we have some students from Lake Mills High School. If they are here, would they and their teachers please stand up? Oh, wonderful. Please be seated. We like to have you come. They are here with a program that we run in combination with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they've had some information about the case that you are going to be arguing to the court. And then on the break at lunch hour, one of the justices will come and speak with the students if you can return. There's another oral argument after this one. And Justice Daniel Kelly, who sits down at the end of the row there, is going to be your presenter over the lunch hour. So if you can come back, and anybody that wants to hear his presentation is certainly welcome to do that as well. Now you have seen, we have seen a little bit of who you are, and I'm going to introduce the court to you also. Beginning on my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to her, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The chair next to her is not currently occupied, just as you can see. Justice Michael Gableman sits in that chair. He will be here for the second argument. He is watching this argument on Wisconsin Eye, so he is participating but won't be here to ask you questions. On the far end, as I said earlier, is Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those preliminary matters out of the way, counsel, are you ready to go? Please begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Colleen Marion, and I represent Mr. Soriano, the defendant appellate petitioner. We're asking for two holdings today. First, we're asking the court to reverse the Court of Appeals and trial court's finding that Mr. Soriano forfeited his right to counsel. Second, we're asking the court to further develop standards to govern forfeiture of counsel in Wisconsin to better protect defendants' rights and also the court's interest in judicial efficiency and a common economy.
What exactly would you like?
I think the best test that I've seen around the country is sort of a three-tiered test where, of course, there's voluntary waiver, which is the traditional test of waiver, knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. Then the second tier would be what courts call waiver by conduct, and I think the Goldberg court in the Third Circuit was the first to lay this out. But in waiver by conduct, if the defendant is acting in a manipulative or dilatory manner, then the court's required to warn the defendant that if the conduct persists, that they could lose their right to counsel, and also advise the defendant about the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. And then if the conduct persists, the court can find that the defendant, by his or her own actions, decided to waive counsel. And then the last tier is forfeiture, and it should be reserved for only extreme circumstances. And in other jurisdictions, it's really only limited to a couple of scenarios. The general categories are violence to counsel and threats of violence to defense counsel. And then the second main category is when a defendant who has the financial means to hire counsel continues to show up to court without counsel. So what I'm asking the court to do is to adopt a similar or that exact test to sort of limit the circumstances under which forfeiture can be found in Wisconsin.
Does the judge have to give warning on forfeiture?
Oh, thank you. No, warnings are not required for forfeiture, which is why forfeiture is reserved for only extreme circumstances. It's considered a very drastic remedy.
I thought you would say that you wanted the adoption of the dissent in one of our cases that Justice Kiske wrote.
Right. So the only time this court has had the opportunity to address forfeiture of counsel was 20 years ago in State versus Cummings. and there was a dissent in which the dissent felt that the circumstances of the case were not drastic enough for forfeiture and wanted something more akin to what other jurisdictions called waiver by conduct, where the court would have been required to provide warnings and advisements to the defendant.
That would have been my next question to you. How is this different from the precedent of State versus Cummings?
So Cummings was prior to this court's really clarification about the differences between waiver and forfeiture. And so the decision sort of uses sort of a combination of those two concepts. The court talks about how the defendant's conduct was demonstrating that he made a choice to go pro se, and also used the word forfeiture. So I think, you know, since Cummings, a lot of other jurisdictions have spent time developing this. Cummings was one of the first cases that I found in the country tackling this issue. It's more of a recent concept. And so since then, there's been a lot of development in the law, and I think it's become clear that more jurisdictions would say that what happened in Cummings closest to waiver by conduct, and therefore there should have been warnings and advisements.
Thank you.
And also, do we have to overturn any cases if we do what you want done?
Well, I think what should happen is that Cummings should be clarified and taken one step further. I think an analogy would be in Pickens, this court said that courts should conduct an on-the-record colloquy for voluntary waiver of counsel. And then in Klesig, which actually came after Cummings, the court changed that to a mandatory colloquy. So we'd be asking for the same type of step to require warnings. Because the majority in Cummings thought that the warnings and advisements were a good idea. The majority just didn't take the final step of requiring.
Well, the majority in Cummings didn't find that that colloquy was constitutionally required, correct?
I guess, I can't remember if it was explicit, but the court did talk about the constitutional standards in the beginning of its analysis, so I would assume that that's the implication, is that the court didn't feel that warnings and advisements were constitutionally required.
So if we decided today that those are required, wouldn't that require overruling Cummings?
I think, if I can recall correctly, Klesig did use the term overrule, referring to Pickens. I think modification of the law doesn't always require overruling a case. I think of it more as developing it further. Cummings was, most of the decision was about John Doe proceedings, and the forfeiture of counsel analysis was, I would say, secondary. It was much shorter. I guess I would leave it up to the court whether the court believes that accepting our rule or suggestions would require overruling Cummings.
Is there anything that has occurred since our ruling in Cummings that suggests that it is now inadequate?
Which court? From which court?
Us.
From this court? I think Klesig, possibly. Klesig came out after Cummings, and the court required that the record really demonstrate an explicit colloquy with defendants about their voluntary waiver of counsel. Klesig spends a lot of time talking about how important this right is, how primary the Supreme Court feels that it is, and probably the most important constitutional right that defendants have. The court said that, you know, lawyers are necessities, not luxuries, that we need to indulge every reasonable presumption against the loss of the right to counsel. Without counsel, justice cannot be done. So I think looking at Klesig and the development of other colloquies and various other constitutional areas, for example, in Wisconsin, you need to have an on-the-record colloquy for the waiver of the right to testify, jury trial, right to be present. So I think it does fit with the growing jurisprudence in Wisconsin.
Isn't the reason for the required colloquy in Klesig that we are dealing with a question of intent, right? So we want to know, is the defendant intentionally waiving a constitutional right?
Right.
Isn't that why we require that colloquy?
Yeah.
Okay. And when we're dealing with a defendant's actions, we can tell the import of his actions just as well as anyone else, right? We don't need a colloquy about his actions. We can see what they are.
Well, I disagree. I think that actions, unless there is other factors, can be interpreted in various ways. I think that's why it's important to have the warnings and advisements, and so you're putting the defendant on notice. Then if the conduct persists, you can make a reasonable inference that it's intentional and done with knowledge of the likely consequence.
Is it required that we find intent before we find waiver by conduct or forfeiture?
That's how I read Cummings. Yeah.
It requires intent.
I think so, yes. An intent to delay the trial or disrupt the proceeding. And then, even on a prior case in Keller, this court had reversed the trial court's finding of forfeiture where the defendant showed up without counsel because the court said there wasn't enough of a showing that it was purposeful with the intent to delay or disrupt the trial. So I think in the majority of circumstances,
bless you.
Waiver and waiver by conduct are the preferable and constitutional options. I think forfeiture should be extremely rare, and the Court of Appeals acknowledged that in Coleman.
Counsel, what are we to make, if anything, out of Attorney Singh's refusal to meet with Mr. Suriano unless they could meet where he had to first go through a metal detector because he was afraid of him? What are we to make of that?
He had a subjective feeling about the client. He did not allege that there were any threats or any other events that were specific that made him feel that way. A lot of people who are facing the government on a criminal case are upset and frustrated. And I think that's just part of the attorney's job, is to accommodate that and also try to work things out. I think if there was a finding by the judge that there had been a threat or actual violence in this case, then it would be a different situation.
So we should just ignore that, is essentially what you're telling me.
No, I think that if we consider this more of a waiver by conduct case, that the judge could have advised the client, look, you need to cut it out, try to deter the conduct, and try to have the lawyer and client work together. Part of that's explaining to both parties which decisions are theirs to make. Defendants need to be told that they're going to have to defer to their lawyer on like a lot of decisions, actually.
Why is that the court's job to instruct the defendant of that?
Well, I think especially when there's already tension in the relationship between counsel and the defendant, it could really sound coercive or I think inappropriate for the lawyer to be taking on the role of explaining the different roles and warning the defendant about consequences of conduct. Also, the Supreme Court has made it really clear that trial courts have a special protecting duty when it comes to defendants and representation of counsel. And so the Supreme Court has already said that courts need to be involved. They need to, I guess, be in charge of the ship and make sure that the defendant rights are being protected.
Does that extend to mediating the relationship between the attorney and his client?
I think so, to a certain extent. I think the court should encourage counsel and the defendant to work together. I don't think that lawyers should be like dumping their clients because they don't like them. So I think it's important for the court to provide guidance to both the lawyer and the defendant.
Well, you can't really get off a case once you're counsel without the permission of the court, correct?
Right.
So they aren't really dumping, as you say, the client. They're coming before the court and asking to be relieved of representation.
You're right. That was the wrong word.
If it is the court's role to mediate the relationship between the attorney and his client, is that a constitutional requirement?
I think the constitutional requirement is to make sure that if the defendant winds up without an attorney, that every reasonable step was taken to prevent that. I think that lawyers take their clients as they come when it comes to appointed counsel. The client doesn't have a right to counsel of choice, and I don't think that attorneys have a right to or shouldn't be filing a motion to withdraw just because they aren't getting along with their client. But, you know, if the client really is persisting in misconduct, the court can alert the defendant to that. I'm not saying the court's not without recourse. And then if the misbehavior persists, then the court would certainly be within its power and right to decide that the defendant, by his own actions, has waived the right to counsel.
I found it interesting that both you and the state, as well as the amicus, and I see that Attorney Ehrman is going to have 5 minutes of argument, but that you all relied on the main case, Nisbet case. And so you all think that that case supports you. State thinks so, you think so. So I find that interesting because when I read Nisbet, it says a lot of things, especially about forfeiture. You picked out what favors you, namely you have to have egregious circumstances, extreme circumstances. And there it was the threat of violence or violence. Except the court didn't hang it only on that. In terms of forfeiture, it looked at a whole, what do they call, constellation of factors. And then, in addition to that, the court said you had a warning on a forfeiture, too.
I cited the main case, and mostly in response to the state's contention mm-hmm. that it was really similar to this case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's necessarily the most clear decision. I like Goldberg. I think it's pretty clear. It lays out the three tiers. You know, it uses some terms that needed fleshing out, like extremely dilatory conduct. And that's been fleshed out by further decisions from that court and other courts to really define what that means. But I think basically what I would advocate is the three-tiered system so that we make sure the defendants are being warned about their conduct before they can be found to have just forfeited it, and to make sure that we're really having a system that holds to the presumption against forfeiture or waiver of constitutional rights.
So you want this court to hold he didn't forfeit?
Correct.
You want us to hold he didn't waive?
Correct.
Didn't waive because it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, right?
Right.
And what about waiver by conduct? What is the standard there for you?
Well, I think that waiver by conduct is considered similar to waiver, except we're not using the words and we're not expressly saying it. So with the warnings given, you're still saying that the waiver by conduct was knowing and voluntary. You're just looking for different evidence of the waiver decision. You're not looking for the defendant to say, I'm waiving counsel, but you are seeing that the defendant's persisting in conduct that you already warned the defendant would result in
the
loss of
the right.
So the
conduct has to show knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of counsel, but it has to be done with a warning. So
yeah.
That otherwise it might not be knowing, intelligent.
Right.
You may be able to find it in something else. So you want a new trial. I found this case very interesting because the penalty really is quite small, right?
I can't speak for how Mr. Soriano would feel
about
it. It's not a prison sentence.
In the criminal justice system, it's quite small. How much is the penalty here?
It was a $100 fine, but with court costs, it was $814.
Oh.
And he had to pay within 60 days, or there'd be jail time.
I think we should cut those by half. What do you think?
I agree. or more.
Counsel,
well,
at what point
do
you...
That's the reason I asked this question, because the statutes provide for maybe a small $100 is money, but compared to fines of $10,000 and more, it's really quite small. And the amount of jail time is very small here, right?
The penalty could have been up to 9 months in jail, though.
Okay.
You're not arguing somehow that a person's constitutional rights are different if their penalties are lower versus someone's constitutional right to counsel if the penalties are more severe?
No, absolutely not. Whatever rule this comes out of this case would apply to somebody who's facing life imprisonment for first-degree intentional homicide.
Counsel, at what point do you figure that the court ruled that Mr. Suriano lost his right to counsel?
Actually, I think it's partly because it was a lower stakes case.
I think the question
it was when.
At what point?
Okay, so on the same day that Attorney Singh moved to withdraw, the state made the motion for forfeiture. The court first granted the motion to withdraw, then heard the argument on forfeiture and ruled on forfeiture all on the same day. And the defendant did not have notice of the state's motion. Actually asked to table the motion so that he could prepare a response, but it all happened quickly on the same day.
Now, the
so
court
that
didn't
day was May 17.
Yeah. The court didn't say he couldn't have a lawyer, right? He could go out and retain a lawyer.
Yeah, which is pretty confusing to me. I think the court was saying you don't have a right to counsel anymore, but I might, in my generosity, allow you to have an attorney.
It wasn't confusing to Mr. Suriano, though, right?
I think it was because the court said you forfeited your right to counsel, but go ahead and submit an application for court-appointed counsel.
Right, and he didn't get court-appointed counsel, but he did eventually retain counsel.
No, he didn't. He couldn't afford to retain counsel, so he found a lawyer who was willing to accept court appointment rates and then asked the court to adjourn the trial so that the new attorney could accommodate that. I see my lights on.
Yeah, if you could just, Chief Justice, if you wouldn't mind.
Just finish answering his question.
Oh, okay. I think I did.
You think you did?
Unless you don't think I did.
Yeah, if what I'm wondering is, did he lose the right to counsel when the court chose not to adjourn the suppression hearing, or did he lose the right to counsel prior to that?
I think for clarity of the record, I mean, the court has to make a finding. The court's finding was prior to the submission of the court appointment counsel request. I think we have to take the judge at his word that it was at that moment that Mr. Suriano lost his right to counsel.
What was the date of the suppression hearing?
The date of the suppression hearing was May 27th, and the court ruled on May 14th that he had lost his right to counsel.
Okay. Thank you. We will now hear from Mr. Erlin from the amicus on behalf of the State Public Defender.
I'm Joe Eman, appearing on behalf of the State Public Defender today. And the Public Defender joins in the request that this court clarify or enhance the analysis in Cummings in regard to forfeiture of counsel. The Public Defender is also asking the court to address the circumstances that led to forfeiture in this case and provide guidance to trial attorneys and to circuit court judges when a motion to withdraw is filed based on disagreement between the lawyer and the attorney. None of this is constitutionally required. We're just asking you to provide guidance to courts in that regard.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Just remind me, okay, because it's been 10 years. Remind me, is it that someone can go back to the public defender two times and they can get a lawyer?
One of the things I'm here to say is there's no such thing as a three strikes rule. That's worked its way into some decisions, and it's lurking around the background of this case. There's no constitutional right to appointment of a second attorney when there's disagreement over this stuff. The Constitution doesn't require it. But in Wisconsin, by statute and administrative code rule, PD 2.04, says that when the defendant wants another attorney, wants to fire his lawyer and get another one, the state public defender, with leave of the court, shall honor the request, provided it's the only such request made by the person and change in counsel will not delay the outcome or otherwise be contrary to the interest of justice.
So this case unwound because he went through his requests with the public defender?
Well, the public defender's position is that whenever a court grants an attorney's motion to withdraw at their discretion, we're never going to leave a client alone in court. We will appoint another lawyer. It's just that when we get to the third and fourth and fifth lawyers, we'll talk about this afternoon, it places a great burden on the public defender
right.
to do that because we've got clients waiting for their first.
And what number was this defendant on?
Well, the defendant didn't fire any of his lawyers in this case. The lawyers unilaterally moved to withdraw, three of them.
Right. So he would have been on his fourth lawyer. But three came through the PD?
Yes.
Okay.
And
the fourth would have potentially been court-appointed?
Yeah, it could have been the public defender, too.
Okay.
We would have had the court not ruled on forfeiture, our position is we can and should have appointed another lawyer in this case. We're not going to leave defendants alone.
Okay.
But what I'm asking the court to do is suggest that trial judges do engage in this colloquy. When a client's fired his lawyer based on disagreement over strategy or to clarify for the defendant, there are certain decisions that you get to make, decision to plead guilty or go to trial, to waive a jury, to testify, or to take an appeal. The other legal and strategic decisions are up to the attorney to make in consultation with the client and, you know, hopefully working collaboratively. But when they don't, you know, the lawyer has to respect the decisions that are the client's to make, and the client has to respect the lawyer's. And if the client disagrees, you know, he doesn't get a right to a third or fourth or fifth attorney.
Why are you asking the court to make this statement? Why aren't you the state public defender's office, telling lawyers that they can't seek withdrawal if they're appointed by you, because they're supposed to tell the client that? I mean,
we do. You have greater authority than us.
We may have greater authority, but why is that the court function?
Well, it's just clarifying to the defendant at the hearing on the motion to withdraw that this is the end of it.
Well, the state public defender comes in and says, I want to withdraw. And the judge makes the statement about procedural matters for the lawyer, substantive matters for the client, and that the client can't dictate the procedure and these decisions. Okay. And then what does the judge say? Mr. Public Defender, Ms. Public Defender, you are not going to withdraw.
Deny the motion. Right. And that's what should happen in many cases.
Okay, and that's what you want the court to be saying in this opinion, that the trial court should deny the motion if made
yes.
for that basis.
You two work it out, right. And if a legal conflict develops, I mean, it's something that, so the lawyer can't proceed, of course, can have as many lawyers as come, because he needs to have somebody who can legally represent.
The difficulty with that, if you will, is setting up a record that's sufficient so that it doesn't get, you know, that denial isn't subject to a successful appeal or a mistrial later or, you know, a conflict.
Because there's no right to successive appointments, I guess I don't see how that would be a reversible error to deny
a request
for a new
you know,
lawyer.
Ineffective assistance arguments or, you know, my lawyer wouldn't proceed on this or call these witnesses or wouldn't do this or that. I mean, we get a number of those cases on appeal.
Well, but if there's a strategic reason to not do it, then there's no ineffective assistance. And if there
is, that is putting defense counsel in a pretty difficult position. Is that really what you want? Courts to force lawyers to
one attorney and a second attorney. And the same problem persists, it's likely to persist with the third or the fourth or the fifth.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just wondering how we don't put defense counsel in a terrible quandary there.
Our job's hard.
It also puts defense counsel in the position of not acting as officers of the court, which they have an obligation to do regardless of their representation. They can't go along with filing frivolous motions, for example. They have to follow the rules that are laid down for representation.
That's exactly right. Like the one of the questions the defendant, or things the defendant wanted to do in this case, was take depositions. Well, that doesn't happen in a criminal case. I mean, that's exactly right. One final point, just very short. I would also like the court to remind attorneys when they file motions to withdraw, they still do owe a duty of loyalty to their clients and have to keep confidential information. The motion to withdraw can't be a basis to air grievances in a public document, and be mindful of that when they file motions.
The only one I saw was Attorney Erickson, but he responded to a direct question from Mr. Singh, so he had to answer the question in court, and he did say things that were quite damaging.
Right, well, Attorney Singh, too, though, talked about a lot of things on
yes,
the
yes, that was, that's that you're right.
Counsel, you finish your brief with saying that you request that this court provide guidance to circuit courts. I understand your other requests. Remind me of exactly what you want by that. Are you wanting what you had just mentioned, of course, is earlier in your brief, about once they're off, they still have a duty of loyalty to their client. I mean, what
no,
is
the guidance thing is the motion to withdraw. When that happens, and many judges do this, I should say, already, that they tell the, you know, they cover the, what's the client's decision to make, what's the lawyer's decision to make, and tell the client you're not going to get a third if there's continued disagreement between with your next lawyer. And but if the court lets him go, again, I want to emphasize, the public defender's position is we're going to give him a third lawyer. We don't think anybody should have to stand alone in court facing the prosecutor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is the state ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy on behalf of the respondent, Wisconsin. This court in State v. Cummings held that a defendant may forfeit his right to counsel when the circuit court becomes convinced that the orderly and efficient progression of the case is being frustrated by the defendant's voluntary and deliberate choices. Cummings was correctly decided. The forfeiture standard it set out is workable and is followed by courts across the country. And the standard was met here.
What's the standard?
The standard is forfeiture may occur when the circuit court becomes convinced that the orderly and efficient progression of the case is being frustrated by the defendant's voluntary and deliberate choices. And that standard can correctly govern the three different types of forfeiture cases that have been cited to the court in the briefing. So the first are physical assault cases where a defendant attacks an attorney, perhaps doesn't even cause any meaningful delay in the trial. That still could be governed by the Cummings standard. Same with the failure to hire cases where a defendant is given ample time to hire their own attorney out of their own pocket and they fail to do so. And then the multi-factor cases, like the case here, where you have multiple attorneys withdraw due to the defendant's misconduct. Now my friend on the other side admitted that the three-tiered structure for waiver, waiver by conduct, and forfeiture is an acceptable rule, and the state agrees. The only difference between our position and my friend's position is that she thinks only forfeiture should govern those first two types of forfeiture cases, the physical assault and then the failure to hire cases, but it shouldn't govern the multi-factor cases like the case here. I don't think there's any meaningful distinction in the substance of those types of cases with respect to the right of counsel that justifies that distinction.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that Cummings' case, when looked at the lens of more recent jurisprudence, is really a waiver by conduct rather than a forfeiture by conduct case?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that.
I note that you were careful, I think careful, in indicating that Cummings' holding also emphasized the defendant's voluntary and deliberately chose to engage in that behavior. And those are often terms of art that we use when we assess whether something is knowingly done. Whether there's a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. I mean, those are the words that we normally attend with a waiver analysis rather than a forfeiture analysis. The knowing and the deliberate.
So, Your Honor, in Cummings, I believe the standard says voluntary and deliberate.
I'm sorry, voluntary and deliberate.
Right, and I think there's a great difference between that and then knowing, which is the word that is more associated with express waiver. And the difference is the defendant need not know that their actions will result in the loss of this particular right, the right to counsel.
Depends on how you define deliberate, right?
Yeah. That's true, but I think taken in context in Cummings, deliberate refers to the defendant actually choosing to engage in this behavior. The fact that the defendant does not know the legal consequences of the behavior, that's irrelevant to the forfeiture analysis. And indeed, that's actually the lack of that warning requirement is another way to phrase it, where the court will warn you what the legal ramifications of your behavior are. The fact that that is not there is an important feature of the forfeiture doctrine, an important feature of that three-part system that counsel on the other side raised in the opening argument. And the reason why it's important is that it allows a circuit court to act, when the defendant's behavior is truly extreme and where a warning would either be costly or futile. And there's three particular costs to what would essentially be merging the waiver by conduct category with the forfeiture category, where you would require warning in all instances, no matter the egregiousness of the defendant's behavior. And those costs are, it would encourage defendants to game the system with particularly egregious behavior. They could engage in exceedingly harsh misconduct, wait for their warning, and only then change the system. The court system shouldn't be susceptible to that type of gamesmanship. The second is there would simply be more waste of court resources, including time, which is precisely the evil that forfeiture doctrine is designed to eliminate. And third is, in some cases, as counsel for the other side admits, there's a very real risk of harm, particularly in those physical attack cases. Requiring a warning and the same counsel to persist in representation or subjecting a new attorney to that dangerous situation is a tall order for counsel. And the court should not require that type of burden to attend to public defenders.
Well, you know, there's a big cost of making a distinction between or among three types of losing your right to counsel. And regardless of how the court will define those three or give criteria for the three, namely waiver by conduct, and forfeiture, there are always going to be cases that fall somewhere in between. And they are very costly. It takes a trial, a court of appeals, and sometimes here. And this is a good example. Isn't it just easier to say that the trial judge has to have a colloquy? They may know how to do it. They do it with guilty pleas all the time, because most cases are settled by guilty pleas, right?
Plea bargains, yes, that's correct.
Whether or not you have a plea agreement, there's a plea.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
Okay, all right. So why not just have a rule that says you're a bad boy or girl, whether it's dilatory purpose, whether you've been bad to your, including threat of violence to your lawyer, you can you can eliminate your right to counsel. And I'm warning you, you're on that track. And you persist in when whatever it is, I'm going to say that to you. Do you understand that? Do you understand the dangers of not having a lawyer, how complicated it is to go ahead, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's all written out in the bench book or in the SMs. So why not just say, here's the way you always do it, period. Get rid of all this three-part test. This is what the trial court has to do. Trial court does it. It is the right counsel.
So, Your Honor, the reason...
I said, that's it. Then we don't have to decide, is it forfeiture, waiver by conduct, waiver. We just have one set procedure, and we go.
The reason why the court should not merge the two categories and require... merge the waiver by conduct, which does require a warning, and then forfeiture, which does not.
And plain waiver.
That's right, and plain waiver, which doesn't.
Step three.
That's right. So the reason why a warning should not be required in every instance is that there are situations in which the defendant does engage in truly egregious behavior in which a warning would be futile because the defendant knows...
It may be futile, but how much time does it take?
Well, it's not just the time that the actual colloquy takes. It's that in order to have any meaning, the warning has to give the defendant another shot. Otherwise, it's just an explanation of what's happening in the court. So, and in this case, really...
It was a three-month delay. We're not talking about 3 years. We're talking about a three-month delay.
Yes, that's
we
right, Your Honor.
Nothing in trial courts.
I disagree with that. The court here did express a particular dissatisfaction with the delay in a simple misdemeanor case such as
that's
this.
That's right. That's why I keep stressing what the penalty was.
Certainly.
Because that would explain the judge's view that this defendant has a minor penalty issue, and that this judge has to take all this time and effort with this when there are more significant to the public criminal cases.
So
or maybe the judge was just trying to follow some of the guidelines this court requires of judges to decide cases in a timely fashion, and certain cases have a time limit that we say is appropriate to complete your casework within. Who knows?
Certainly, Your Honor. And Cummings said the warning requirement is recommended, and the reason why it should remain recommended is that waste is only one concern with having a rigid warning requirement. The other is gamesmanship. The court system should not be susceptible to that gamesmanship. The third is risk of harm, of physical harm to opposing counsel. And it's very important in the context of this case to understand when forfeiture occurred. That occurred after the withdrawal hearing with Attorney Singh. That's when the court first learned that perhaps there's a danger of physical harm to some of the trial actors here when Attorney Singh said, the hostility and anger that this man has shown to me is such that I will not meet with him at any location that does not have screening with a metal detector. That's at Record 73, pages 12 to 13. So that's when forfeiture occurred, when the circuit court might have thought, we're actually getting close to a physical harm type of forfeiture case. We need to cut it off here because we've already met the standard for that multi-factor case. So that's why forfeiture needed to happen. So my friends on the other side have cited Smith versus Grams. It's a Seventh Circuit case.
Before you get to Smith, I'm looking at the special materials that we have for our judges, or we provide that are written by our criminal jury instruction committee, and specifically special material 30. Are you familiar with that?
I am not, Your Honor, unfortunately. Is this the special jury instruction?
It's special materials 30. It's not a jury instruction. In our special materials, we tell judges oftentimes how to do things.
Yes, sir.
It's in the jury instruction.
books.
Certainly,
yes,
certainly.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's
yes.
right. It's the last one.
Okay.
Special materials. And it sets forth a suggested inquiry. But if you're not familiar with it, I guess I won't be able to ask you what's wrong with just following this suggested inquiry
so
in our special materials.
If I may, I believe it is, that was cited in the opening brief. I confuse it with a jury instruction.
It is. It's at page 21.
Yes.
I'm asking this question just as prefatory to set you to set the stage so that I can ask you about the individual questions. But I don't want to ask you about the individual questions unless you're familiar with it. So are you familiar with it?
If I'm correct in my understanding, I believe it tracks the recommended procedure in Cummings.
With a little more detail. That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay, so I'd be happy to take
Do
questions.
Do you have any problem with the court adopting this procedure?
Yes, if it is... If this court adopts that as mandatory, I do think that would be a mistake.
And what in this suggested procedure set forth in SM 30 causes you a problem?
The particular requirement that before forfeiture can occur, a warning must be given. I don't think that should be a blanket requirement in all forfeiture cases. And the reason is because it can make the court susceptible to gamesmanship, encourages more waste, and then physical harm cases or cases approaching those circumstances, it can cause a real risk of harm to attorneys. Now, it's important to remember, there is a separate category, this waiver by conduct doctrine. The circuit court can easily work in between these three categories. Express waiver is certainly easy. The defendant has said, I would like to proceed pro se, and therefore the colloquy happens. Now, waiver by conduct, all that is required is the same types of warnings for express waiver. It's just that the defendant has not expressly said they would like to proceed pro se. What has happened is the defendant has engaged in less serious misconduct. So the court can say, well, I have this misconduct before me. Let's take extra caution. I'll give the warnings and set up the waiver by conduct doctrine. And when the conduct continues, I can say, all right, you've lost your right to counsel now. You've waived it by your conduct. That's precisely what the court recommended in Cummings. And now in this case, if we did not have Attorney Singh, if we did not have his extended testimony about the abuse that has been directed towards him by Mr. Siriano, this would be a waiver by conduct case, and we would lose because the warnings did not happen. But we do have Attorney Singh. We do have his statement that the hostility and anger Mr. Siriano has shown is such that he will not meet with him at any location that does not have screening with a metal detector. I'd like to circle back and just reassure the court that this type of forfeiture without an explicit warning is certainly constitutional. Now, there's that Illinois versus Allen case, which was the right to be present at trial. The court held that could be forfeited. Now, there is talk about a warning in Allen, but it's helpful to look at the Gilchrist case. That's the Second Circuit case from then-Judge Sotomayor. That case characterized Allen as not requiring warnings before removal in all cases, but in any event, Allen should be read in conjunction with Taylor versus United States, which is 414 U.S. 17. In that case, the defendant failed to show up mid-trial. No warning was given that the trial would continue despite the defendant's absence. The defendant was convicted, and that conviction was affirmed. The same similar circumstance, and certainly the right to be present at trial is on the same tier as the right to counsel. Perhaps one is more important than the other, but they're certainly fundamental criminal procedural rights. And then just to press the point a little bit further, this is State versus Vaughn, which is 2012 Wisconsin Appellate 129, unfortunately not cited in the briefs. It says it was a right to testify case. The defendant refused to show up at trial. He was convicted. He challenged the loss of his right to testify since he wasn't there. He couldn't speak on his own behalf. And the Court of Appeals held that the right could be forfeited without particular warnings. So this type of forfeiture, the Supreme Court has not explicitly talked about forfeiture of counsel, but the Supreme Court has talked about forfeiture of fundamental rights.
What do you mean by fundamental rights?
Fundamental in the sense that they are rights that every criminal trial should have, and without them, we really don't have anything that resembles the American criminal trial.
I know, but the fundamental rights, they're put forth in the Constitution.
Certainly, I think all of what we call a fundamental right is in the Constitution. Perhaps we would characterize some that are in the Constitution not necessarily fundamental, but nevertheless, they are certainly important.
Okay, so yeah, all the rights are derived from the Constitution. Some in the Constitution are reviewed as fundamental, and others are not.
That's correct.
That's your point?
That's my point, yes.
And the court has, U.S. Supreme Court has labeled some as in these constitutional rights fundamental or not fundamental.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you get any rights that are not derived from the Constitution?
Yes.
Which ones? But where are they derived from? Statutes? Common law?
To take it, I guess, a step back and more, I mean, the Constitution secures rights and guarantees rights, particularly in the criminal process where
right.
the state meets the private party in a particular way. My point in all this is that just because we label a right as fundamental, that doesn't mean it can't be forfeited. The
okay.
forfeiture solves the problem of what do you do when one right clashes with another right. The state's right to prosecute defendants and hold them accountable for their crimes after a fair trial, and the defendant's right to have counsel. What do you do when those two conflict? What do you do when the defendant refuses to hire counsel to thwart the ability of the state to convict him? And the answer is, you apply this forfeiture doctrine. So if I could just apply the Cummings test here, there's three main factors that the state thinks together support the finding of the holding of forfeiture. First, Mr. Siriano had three lawyers, and each withdrew due to his own misconduct, and only after a hearing in which he was allowed to ask questions. So with Attorney Erickson, he testified at his withdrawal hearing that, speaking to Mr. Siriano, you believe you've been improperly charged. Because of that, you desire to make it difficult or frustrating for the court system to proceed. That's almost a word-for-word quote of what the Cummings standard is. He says that Mr. Siriano wants to explore every legal or even non-legal aspect of this case for reasons of making it difficult or frustrating for the legal system. And with Attorney Schaefer, we have in her affidavit that a significant conflict has developed, and because of this, she can no longer effectively represent him. And Mr. Siriano expressly declined to comment on that affidavit or any of the testimony with respect to Attorney Schaefer at her withdrawal hearing. And then, of course, with Attorney Singh, we have the most important statement is the hostility and anger he has shown, such that I will not meet with him at any location that does not have screening with a metal detector. Mr. Siriano called him a shill for the prosecution. He said, how many defendants have you escorted to conviction rather than defending them? Attorney Singh said, not bringing his withdrawal hearing and not bringing these facts to the court's attention would be tantamount to committing a fraud upon the court. Now, this is especially important. Mr. Siriano was asked, do you dispute, or rather, Mr. Singh made the kind of the rhetorical question, he doesn't dispute any of this. And Mr. Siriano said, I'll say it again, it's all true. And that's record 73, page 15.
How do you walk that careful line and stay on the right side of it vis-a-vis the duty of loyalty that is being espoused in the brief and argument of amicus? You have comments from counsel that are disparaging, that will leave a negative effect on anyone who hears it about your client, and as was voiced from the bench, the line on the other side is, you know, candor to a tribunal or officer of a court. So tell me how you walk that line.
So I have two things to say, and first I'd like to, first is a prefatory comment, and then I'll answer the question, I hope, directly. The first is that issue has not been expressly raised in the briefing, and so the state doesn't have an official position on that in particular at this moment in this case. However, to get to the substance of the question, to hopefully provide candor myself, perhaps this court could institute some sort of proceedings to direct circuit courts on how best to take this sort of testimony, because, of course, it is the circuit court's responsibility to grant the motion to withdraw. And one of the reasons why a withdrawal motion should be granted is the total breakdown of the attorney-client relationship. The only people who know whether that has occurred, the facts about that, are the attorney and the defendant. So perhaps a proceeding, and this has been suggested, I believe, in the California Reporter case cited by my friends on the other side, is that perhaps the prosecutor could be excluded. Other than that, I think it just we need to rely on the discretion of the circuit court, which is a particular point that the Illinois versus Allen case had brought up, that a lot of yes, Your Honor.
That's kind of what I was talking to Mr. Amon about. That's a fine line to walk. Wouldn't we have to maybe overrule some of our cases that deal with competency issues that come up in court? I mean, courts can't delve too far into why defense counsel is saying, hey, we need a competency evaluation. You kind of have to take that and say, I understand your request. You can't say, well, why, what was said, you know, and go into it or take testimony. Why would we deal with this? What, should we deal with this the same way, differently? How far do you go down that? It's the same question you're asking, I think, Justice Bradley.
It's certainly a fair point, and I would think the court should treat this the same way it treats competency. Certainly competency raises some sensitive issues that are raised just as well when you have an irrevocable breakdown of an attorney-client relationship.
Well, do you go along with the amicus brief? They say, hey, this is an issue of what's your choices here, Mr. Defendant, and what are your choices here, Mr. Attorney? And that you explain that to the attorney and to the, especially the defendant, and say, look, you can't control the attorney on these matters. So you may think there's irreconcilable differences and you want a divorce, but they're not irreconcilable. I have now reconciled you. Here's what you are entitled to talk about and decide, and here's what the attorney is entitled to talk about and decide, and that's the way it's going to be. Do you both understand that? So you can't withdraw, and you are to behave yourself.
My response is, this court and no appellate court can predict all of the conflicts that will arise in any particular case, and that's why we rely on the general abuse of discretion standard for a lot of these issues, including the withdrawal of counsel. And so I think the best rule the court can lay down for that circumstances is the discretion of the trial court.
I know, but you just said that this court ought to direct the trial court how to take the counsel's position about withdrawal. You just said that.
What kind
of direction do you want us to give? At least the amicus brief, I don't know if I agree with them, but at least they had direction and made sense to me because the courts have said that. What direction do you want?
My only answer there, Your Honor, is that perhaps a procedure like the exclusion of the prosecutor would be appropriate. However, it's not raised directly in this case. I haven't briefed this issue extensively, and so that is my answer.
Are you entitled to any due process as the state?
Pardon?
Are you entitled to due process as the state?
Is the state entitled to
yeah.
due process?
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
state is entitled to... The due process clause says no state shall, but there are notions of the state having the right to conduct a fair trial
sure.
and to reach a resolution. So
sure. And why you would want to exclude the state? I don't want to exclude the state.
So
you should be there and give counsel to the court.
My point on this, Your Honor, is that in certain circumstances, if there's a concern of divulging confidentiality facts between an attorney and a client, perhaps that is an appropriate issue. But if I could just get back to this case and talk about the next two factors that the state thinks supports a forfeiture finding here under Cummings. My first one was that he had three lawyers and each withdrew in large part to his own misconduct. The second is that there was a deliberate and an unreasonable delay in the court proceedings. Now, this is clear from the record. It was a three-month delay. The circuit court was particularly aware that this was a straightforward case. Indeed, the trial was resolved in a single day. And the third point is that warnings were given from the court about trial dates and the need for Mr. Sergano to retain counsel. And what that does is show, it just highlights the fact that Mr. Sergano's behavior was voluntary and deliberate. So the court, after Attorney Erickson, said that we're talking about a pretrial a month from now. They talk about the three strikes rule. Now, I'm not saying the rule is set out in the statutes. What I'm saying is the court explicitly said at some point the public defender's office is not going to appoint you a new attorney. You need to address the situation.
What does deliberate mean? Does it mean intentional? Does it mean with purpose? What does it mean?
I think deliberate means that the defendant is engaging in the behavior of his own will. That he is not, just so for example, he is not legally incompetent. He does not have a psychological issue that is compelling his behavior. That's what it means.
Well, how about this? Here's the dictionary definition. Deliberate, done with or marked by full consciousness of the nature and effects. That's the first definition. There are a few others, but is that your definition of deliberate?
No, because as I said at the beginning of my oral argument, is that the standard does not require full knowledge of the legal effects.
So where do you come up with your definition? I just pulled an ad random dictionary definition, and that's their first definition. Where do you come up with your definition of deliberate?
So for the definition of deliberate, I was just drawing on past experiences of the word in the common usage. I don't think that the Cummings case took deliberate as it would perhaps be in a statute. It's a court opinion that uses words in contexts that are different than or less precise. The important point is that it is voluntary conduct. So again, the standard is just when the circuit court becomes convinced that the orderly and efficient progression of the case is being frustrated by the defendant's voluntary and deliberate choices.
Well, all you're saying is that he's competent to stand trial. That's what you're saying. Behavior of your own will and not legally incompetent. That's voluntary and deliberate. Well, that's all you need is that you can just say he's competent to stand trial.
What I'm saying in this case, Your Honor, is that the particular behaviors that Mr. Siriano engaged in, the misconduct with respect to his counsel, the conduct that elicited the response from Attorney Singh about the metal detectors, those were engaged in voluntarily. Those were voluntary and deliberate.
What isn't a voluntary?
So
what is not voluntary?
Things that are not voluntary are actions that are elicited by a mental illness, for example. If we had an incompetent defendant, then the forfeiture doctrine wouldn't be able to attach.
Okay, but you're saying if he's competent, then the forfeiture automatically applies.
I'm saying defendants that are competent are susceptible to be on the receiving end of the forfeiture doctrine.
Okay, but then what you need is, according to you, I think, that if they're competent, there'll be a forfeiture if there's misconduct. Here was firing, in effect, three lawyers. He didn't fire them, but made it so that they wanted to terminate. And two, unreasonable delay. That's it. And your third category was voluntary and deliberate, but we know voluntary and deliberate means competent.
May I answer, Your Honor? Red light is on.
Yes, please.
My point is that one way we know the standard, the voluntary and deliberate and the efficient and orderly progression standard has been met, is that he did, in fact, engage in behavior that resulted in a delay. Thank you, Your Honor.
So I would like to also focus on the facts of this case for my rebuttal. First of all, there's a lot of discussion that makes it sound like the court made findings that it didn't make. The court never stated a finding that Mr. Siriano intended to delay the trial. Mr. Siriano didn't ask for any of his lawyers to withdraw. He kept urging the court to schedule a motion on his suppression hearing. The court did say it seemed like he was playing a game, but to what end? You know, it seemed like what was going on was that Mr. Siriano wanted to have a bigger role in all of the decisions that were going on in this case. And then secondly, with the discussion of hostility and anger, the court never made a finding that there was any conduct that was threatening or any talk that was threatening.
Counsel, in order for the court to do that, wouldn't the court have to inquire into what might be attorney-client privileged information?
Well, I think actually a threat to commit a crime would be, and if it was a credible threat, that would be exempt. And I think if the court wants to know more about why an attorney's withdrawing, they can order the attorney to respond. The attorney should be guarding the privilege of the defendant.
And would it be appropriate for the court to rely on defense counsel as being an officer of the court engage in a transmission of information that is guarded so that counsel can give the court the information it needs to understand the gravity of the situation while simultaneously protecting the client's confidences? Isn't that possible?
Well, a lot of other jurisdictions actually think the defendant should have due process rights at these kind of hearings, where they have counsel to advocate for them, where the attorney testifies, and the court just doesn't make factual findings just based on the representation of counsel alone.
Are you suggesting an embedded adversarial proceeding in which there is another attorney appointed to find out whether the existing attorney ought to be withdrawn?
That's how it works in some other jurisdictions.
Is that what you're asking us to do?
Not necessarily. I think we're kind of just asking for the basics here. And
okay. Well, if that's not what you're asking, then isn't a trial court entitled to rely on defense counsel's representations as an officer of the court to convey the gravity of the situation with his relationship with his client?
I suppose maybe, you know, in this case, the court said, I'm not blaming you 100%, refused to even, you know, make a finding that this was all Mr. Soriano's fault. You know, there was one case where the lawyer comes in with a ruptured eardrum. It's obvious what happened.
There are limits to the candor with which a defense lawyer can act in a trial court setting, right? I mean, I just go back to the competency type situation where defense counsel has to convey certain information to the court, but yet be careful not to convey too much information to the court. And I think this court has said that has to be the procedure employed.
Right. And I wanted to talk about competency. So,
by the way, competency and knowing intentional and voluntary activity are not synonymous, are they?
No, actually, for waiver of counsel, the court also has to find that the defendant's competent to proceed.
So
that's a requirement for every single case of self-representation. With competency, the result of an attorney raising it is an evaluation into the defendant's basically ability to stand trial in a constitutional manner. Just taking the lawyer's word for it in this context means the defendant loses the most important right that they have and faces the government alone. So I think, you know, I'm not saying that there's not a delicate line to draw with confidences and that type of thing, but I just want to make it clear that it's the court's responsibility to make sure that the defendant is protected and to provide warnings in almost every situation would be not very cumbersome and would also be very beneficial, not just to the defendant, but to the court, too.
Well, do you think voluntary and deliberate is a requirement for forfeiture?
No, I don't. Under Cumming, like I said before, I think Cumming sort of mushes together waiver by conduct and forfeiture. I'm not saying there's never a situation where a defendant cannot lose right to counsel. Oh, I'm sorry, my red light's on.
Finish the answer to my question. You may finish the answer to Justice Abrahamson's question. Thank
you. Okay, yes. For example, if an attorney is assaulted by their client, that would be an exception. It's going to be exceedingly rare. But for almost every type of conduct beyond that, yeah, I think that there needs to be a knowing and voluntary factor to it. The knowing part would be getting the Faretta warnings so that you are aware of the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. And the voluntary part would be, and knowing, would be taking actions knowing what the consequence is.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you both for very, very interesting, all three of you, interesting arguments, important questions for the court to consider. We will take a brief break now so that the students that are here can leave and another group can come in.